The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 23, 2020. This is the date I am recording the magazine. The Time cover is traditional with the red border, Time in large capital letters emblazoned on the top center, and above that in white block lettering, a Time to Heal. Below that is a photograph of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, President-elect and Vice-President-elect of the United States. They're clasping hands. They're wearing, each of them, a black mask. She's clad in white. As I recall, this was a white pantsuit with a very shiny, satiny, off-white blouse, the bow or tie of which is visible at her neckline. Joe Biden is wearing either a very dark navy blue or black suit, white shirt, and blue and white, somewhat checkered, it looks like, tie. From her eyes, from Harris's eyes, one very much supposes she is smiling behind that mask, possibly so, too, with the crinkled appearance at the edges of Biden's eyes. Covering 2020 is the first article. This is by Edward Felsenthal, editor-in-chief and CEO. The heading says, from the editor. Early last year, I went to a small dinner in New York for one of my predecessors in this job, former Time editor turned best-selling biographer, professor, and PBS host Walter Isaacson. We wound up talking about, what else, the upcoming election. Time had a particularly important role to play this season, Walter suggested. With the stakes so high and a record number of contenders in the mix, why not do in-depth profiles interviewing the major candidates so that we get to know just not just their positions and platforms, but who they are as human beings? And so we did. Time contributor Anand Giridharadas traveled some 6,000 miles with Bernie Sanders in search of the candidate's inner self. Time's Charlotte Alter toured the South Bend, Indiana White House that Pete Buttigieg shares with husband Chasten and dogs Buddy and Truman. Haley Sweetland Edwards talked white papers and policy wonkery with Elizabeth Warren. Lisandra Villa sat with Beto O'Rourke, Andrew Yang, and Julian Castro. Abby Vasulis took us into Amy Klobuchar's Capitol Hill apartment, down to the books on her bookshelf. Correspondent Molly Ball had the winning hand with profiles of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris that captured the candidates searching for their places in a crowded party. They found them. Brian Bennett, who covers the White House for Time, took us deep into the machinery of Donald Trump's campaign. Asked if he, like every other modern president running for re-election, would reach beyond his political base, Trump said it might happen. But I think my base is so strong, I'm not sure I have to do that. He didn't. From there, our team of reporters and producers tracked a campaign of global importance as it met a pandemic of global impact, the two coalescing in a cover this summer about the plague election. They talked to voters, hundreds of them. They reported on the flood of misinformation spread this cycle not so much by foreign actors as by domestic ones. It is a privilege to cover history from a platform like ours, but it's also difficult and daunting, even before you throw in a raging pandemic and the President of the United States building his campaign around an attempt to discredit your work, says Alex Altman, Times Deputy Washington Bureau Chief, who led our coverage alongside Bureau Chief Massimo Calabresi and senior editors Edwards and Krista Marr. I'll recover this week an image from the event where Biden and Harris delivered victory speeches November 7, includes the phrase from Biden's remarks and from Ecclesiastes, A Time to Heal. It is reminiscent of a long-ago Time cover following another season of division and pain on the 1974 issue featuring newly inaugurated President Gerald Ford with the line, "The healing begins." For some reason, as a 7-year-old, I stashed our family's copy away and still have it after all these years. Healing's a long-running theme of Biden's, one that Ball presaged in her original profile of him. Joe's a healer, Biden's wife Jill told her. He feels people's problems because he's been through a lot of it himself. Harris, too, echoed this in her victory speech, committing the new administration to heal the soul of our nation. This healing will not come easy. Biden's win, projected by organizations from the Associated Press to Fox News, is statistically clear and in line with how every presidential election has been called for more than a century. State election officials have reported no irregularities that could affect the outcome, nor has the president cited any. Yet he's making an unprecedented effort to use the levers of government to resist. And of course, there's the ongoing crisis reflected in the masks on the faces of the president-elect and vice-president-elect on our cover. A crisis that continues to disproportionately affect the health and livelihoods of the most marginalized in our society. Our dueling American realities remain. Biden and Harris and all of us have much work ahead. Again, that's from Edward Rosenthal. For the record, this is a collage of very short sayings and other information. He wasn't just a broadcaster. He was part of the family, said Ken Jennings, Jeopardy contestant, paying tribute to the quiz show's long-running host, Alex Trebek, who died November 8. Two, and this number, it's the numeral two, and it's sitting right below a sketch or illustration of two dogs, one of which has its paw on top of a Biden-Harris sign. Two, the number of German shepherds who will live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue when President-elect Joe Biden takes office January 20. They are Champ and Major, who is set to be the first White House shelter dog. It is not a victory, but there is no defeat, said by Nicole Pashinyan, Armenia's prime minister, on signing a November 9 Russian-brokered peace agreement with Azerbaijan, which calls for Armenian troops to leave the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Russian peacekeepers will take their place. 138 million. The estimated number of hours of sleep lost across the U.S. on election night, according to data from health and wellness tracker Wura Ring. I knew that I was more ready than I ever had been in my entire life. Emily Harrington said this in an interview with the New York Times after becoming the first woman to free climb the Golden Gate route of Yosemite's El Capitan in under 24 hours, November 4. I think, frankly, they wanted the courts to do that, but that is not our job, said John Roberts, Chief Justice, addressing congressional attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act during a November 10 hearing. good news of the week, and this is referring to the week in which this was written, because there's been more good news since. Pfizer, P-F-I-Z-E-R, the American pharmaceutical giant, announced November 9 its COVID-19 vaccine was more than 90% effective, according to preliminary findings. The company says it could have 50 million doses ready by the end of 2020. The president can sue a ham sandwich. He can send 1,000 lawyers to Pennsylvania, but it is not going to change the basic fact of the matter. From John Fetterman, Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor, responding to a legal challenge from the Trump campaign aiming to stop the state from counting late-arriving mail ballots postmarked before Election Day in a November 6 interview. How Biden Won with a Promise to Make America Good Again by Charlotte Alter. Here's a photo of Joe Biden in that same, what I'm calling now, a dark navy blue suit, white shirt, and blue and white checked tie, smiling at the crowd with his mask pulled down just so one can see his smile. The only thing more powerful than a dragon is a dragon slayer. For 4 years, Donald Trump's penchant for division and chaos was the dominant force in American life. In the end, after a long and excruciating battle, it was vanquished by Joe Biden's promise of decency, unity, and national healing. Biden's win was at once widely anticipated and stubbornly doubted, and came after days of agonizing vote counts that began with deficits in key swing states. Biden stayed calm through early defeats on election night, urged patience during delays in crucial states, and projected confidence despite torrents of disinformation spread by the president. By November 7, it was clear Biden had rebuilt the so-called blue wall that crumbled in 2016, first Wisconsin, then Michigan, then finally Pennsylvania tipped in Biden's favor, a slow drumbeat of rejection of a president who had won all three states 4 years ago. In the end, Biden won more votes than any presidential candidate in American history, shattering Barack Obama's record. He won with a coalition of young voters, college-educated suburbanites, and voters of color. Nearly every major Democrat played a role in his ensemble victory. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar helped him win the primary. Bernie Sanders helped him unite the party. Stacey Abrams helped deliver a likely win in an unlikely state, Georgia. Biden's triumph was also a vindication of a style of American politics that many feared was gone forever. A career politician in a nation that claims to loathe them, Biden won not with historic momentum as Obama did, nor by surprise as Trump did, but with the steadfast deliberation of a man who knows who he is and what America needs. Throughout a contentious Democratic primary and a general election upended by a plague, Biden stuck to the same message he has had since he announced his campaign in 2019, a promise to govern with compassion, to provide experience in a time of crisis, to restore the soul of the nation. At first, the message seemed out of step with the times, but then very quickly the times changed. The COVID-19 pandemic made much of the nation yearn for a leader with competence and empathy. In the end, the contrast between candidates broke in his favor, an experienced statesman versus an incompetent president, a leader who comforted COVID-stricken families versus a celebrity who mocked the virus, a candidate who pledged to heal a nation versus an incumbent who had nearly ripped it apart. Messages alone do not win elections. Campaigns do, and Biden's once rickety crew grew into perhaps the most sophisticated digital operation in American political history. After Biden limped out of the primary with a skeletal team and lackluster funding, COVID-19 forced the famously personable candidate to stump from his home office. Biden's team ripped up its playbook and built a state-of-the-art digital shop. running the general election campaign nearly entirely online. Using data-driven texts, calls, and Facebook groups, by the fall, the Biden campaign was like a vintage Corvette with a brand new engine, racing against a monster truck careening off the road. Biden's most important move was to stay the course, keeping out of Trump's way as the incumbent imploded. Trump began 2020 as the third president ever impeached and went on to bungle the federal response to a virus that's killed more than 240,000 Americans. It's always been my feeling that Trump would defeat Trump, says veteran Democratic strategist David Axelrod. Part of politics is being good, and part of politics is being lucky. And Biden was lucky to have Trump as an opponent. But sometimes you make your own luck. And after three presidential campaigns, 36 years in the Senate, and 8 years as vice president, after a lifetime of being almost the right person, at nearly the right time, Joe Biden was finally the man for the moment. That moment was nearly 4 years in the making. Just hours after Trump took the oath of office, millions of activists poured into the streets for the Women's March, considered the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. Then they returned home and started organizing with their neighbors. These new activists, many of them women, ran for office in record numbers. By 2018, their energy flipped the House of Representatives, along with 6 state legislative chambers and 7 governor's seats. By the time the presidential primary rolled around, the base was primed and ready. When Biden joined the race in April 2019, it was an old soldier stepping into one final battle. After 8 years of serving as vice president to the most popular figure in the party, and with decades of deep relationships to build on, it was no surprise that polls registered him as the front runner. The president's impeachment over a do-us-a-favor call to the president of Ukraine flowed from efforts to sabotage the possibility of a Biden candidacy. The president regarded him as the only Democrat who could beat him. Yet as the race began, the presumptive favorite seemed a slow step and 3 years too late. "You don't need to do this," Biden's close friend, Delaware Senator Chris Coons, recalls telling him. "But does the country need me to do this?" Biden replied. "Yes," Coons told him, "you are the candidate who can win." Biden launched his campaign with a video that called the fight against Trump a battle for the soul of this nation. He called Trump's 4 years an aberration. "But if we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are," he said. "And I cannot stand by and watch that happen." This was the story Joe Biden told about America, a story that barely changed in the ensuing 18 months. In his telling, our country is defined by its fundamental decency. And that decency, more than policy or ideology or economy, was on the ballot. America was a nation full of honorable people who had made a mistake by electing the wrong president, but given half a chance, they would return to their true character. Trump ran on one vision of American greatness. Biden sought a return to American goodness. In a crowded field of movement leaders like Sanders, policy wonks like Senator Elizabeth Warren, and history makers like Buttigieg and Senator Kamala Harris, Biden could barely pack a room, but he made a key decision early to hold firm to the center while his rivals raced to the left. As they argued over the details of Medicare for All, Biden defended Obama's Affordable Care Act. While they gave rousing speeches about revolution and big structural change, he reassured Americans that he could carry them back to a calmer, less political divisive past. At first, nobody seemed to be listening. Biden trailed Buttigieg and Sanders in fundraising and fervor. He came in fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire. He seemed too old, too white, too centrist, too yesterday. The consistent criticism was, oh, Biden's not woke enough. He doesn't have enough followers on Twitter. He's not snappy enough, Coons says. Joe has consistently seen who Middle America still is, and it is easy to miss that if the first thing you do is look at Twitter. So Biden plowed ahead, handshake by handshake, hug by hug, on the trail he did what he's done for more than 40 years, listening as voters confided in him about the worst moments of their lives, because they already knew about his. His wife and daughter killed in a car accident on their way to buy Christmas presents in 1972. His son Beau fell by brain cancer in the prime of his life in 2015. In the elevator on the way to his New York Times editorial board interview, a security guard named Jacqueline turned to him and said, "You're my favorite." Biden did not get the Times endorsement, but got a selfie with Jacqueline. And it turned out the loyalty of people like her would be the most important factor in the race. The campaign kept insisting that if they could just make it to South Carolina, they'd be back in the running. With the help of an endorsement from South Carolina kingmaker, Representative Jim Clyburn, Biden carried the state with decisive support from black voters. It was as important for him to win South Carolina as it was for President Obama to win Iowa, says Valerie Jarrett, a longtime advisor to both men. The race changed overnight, literally. The next morning, Buttigieg took a hard look at his numbers. "By the time I went to bed that Saturday night, that path was slipping away," he said. His dropout and endorsement triggered a moderate consolidation. Senator Klobuchar suspended her campaign and endorsed Biden the same day. Senators Cory Booker and Harris followed suit. Suddenly, the race had narrowed to Biden versus Sanders. 3 days later, it was practically over. On Super Tuesday, March 3, Biden swept 10 of 14 states. A week later, he won primaries in Michigan, Missouri, and Mississippi, establishing the contours of a multiracial coalition that included black voters, suburban voters, and inroads with the white working class. Sanders may have enthralled the Twitterati, but it was clear that swing state voters saw Biden as the one who could beat Trump. Biden did not spend a lot of time trying to appeal to the activist base of the Democratic Party, says progressive strategist Sean McElwee. And one of the things that turns out to be true is that the old school people had a lot of pretty decent ideas of how to make this work. Biden came out of the primary with a lead in the polls, but a slim staff, lots of momentum, but little money. The campaign needed one of those defibrillators you use on heart attack patients, says one senior Biden advisor. So even as the former vice president stuck to his message, he shook up his team. He replaced campaign manager Greg Schultz with veteran operative Jen O'Malley Dillon, who had served as deputy campaign manager for Obama's 2012 re-election and had helped modernize the Democratic Party's data program. O'Malley Dillon set out to rescue a sinking ship that happened to be floating in the right direction. It was not just that she had to refit, she had to construct something barely resembling a typical campaign. There would be no throngs of canvassers, no big rallies, no fancy fundraisers. It was deemed too dangerous for the 77-year-old candidate to campaign in person, so for months he did virtual events from his home. Trump mocked him, but Biden again tuned out the noise. He released a detailed plan to tackle the pandemic and another for rebuilding the economy. Trump went golfing as the COVID-19 death toll approached 100,000. Biden commemorated the grim milestone with a solemn 2-minute video message to the families of the dead. "I think I know what you're feeling," he said. You feel like you're being sucked into a black hole in the middle of your chest. Early on, O'Malley Dillon decided a traditional field operation would not work during a pandemic. Trump's campaign was still knocking on doors and registering voters, but Biden's would be run almost entirely online. So even though her background was in field organizing, O'Malley Dillon turned the Biden campaign into perhaps the largest digital organizing machine in American electoral history. Instead of outsourcing the digital operation, she built it in-house, turbocharging the growth of Biden's email list, spending millions on online advertising, and building a digital staff that was 15 times bigger than it had been in the primary, including many staffers from rival primary campaigns. Former Harris, Warren, and Sanders staffers brought new digital strategies into Biden world, particularly the idea of a national distributed organizing model pioneered by the Sanders campaign, an army of safe state volunteers who could be digitally deployed wherever the campaign needed them. It worked. By September, the digital operation was printing money. Biden and the Democrats raised $364.5 million in August, the largest one-month haul ever by a presidential campaign, a record they broke the following month with $383 million in September. The pandemic made the race a referendum on Trump and kept his failures in the headlines. The president had so many dropped balls, says Republican strategist Ron Bonjean, beginning with his inability to empathize with the American people about the situation they are in. By the fall, Biden had hit his stride. He was an analog candidate with a classic 20th century message, running a 21st century virtual juggernaut. The digital strategy allowed his team to keep a gaffe-prone candidate under wraps, shielding his missteps and blasting his charming moments. It paid off. When Biden tapped Harris as his running mate, the choice was broadcast to supporters via text message instead of leaking to the press, allowing the campaign to channel the excitement over the nomination of the first black woman vice president into hard cash, $26 million in 24 hours, a tremendous fundraising spree. By the fall, Biden outspent Trump nearly 2-1 on the airwaves in battleground states. Digital organizers recruited more than 200,000 volunteers to send hundreds of millions of text messages and phone calls. He also successfully sidestepped most of the attacks Trump could use against him. Biden embraced a robust climate and jobs plan developed with the help of top youth climate leaders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but rejected the idea of a Green New Deal. He supported racial justice protests, but did not join calls to defund the police. Trump tried to attack Biden as part of the radical left, but it rang hollow. Calling him a socialist didn't stick, although the attacks may have resonated with Cubans in Florida. Trump tried bullying Biden at a debate, which backfired. Circulating rumors about the former vice president's son Hunter failed. Stability has been the hallmark of this campaign, in the primary and the general, says Biden's longtime pollster John Anzalone. The campaign stayed focused on the states he needed to win, without getting distracted by Democratic pipe dreams. His advisors always knew the path to victory wound through the upper Midwest, so Biden and his surrogates barnstormed through Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in the final weeks of the campaign. The plan was to boost urban and suburban turnout that had sagged in 2016, while cutting into Trump's rural margins. This strategy required patience and fortitude through what campaign brass knew would be a long election week. Early returns would show Trump in the lead in key states, top staff warned, and it could take days to count the mail-in votes coming out of Democratic strongholds. It was all about sticking to the plan and staying the course, or as Biden and Harris both tweeted, keep the faith. It turned out Biden had been right all along. After 4 years of chaos and division, America did not want a revolution. It just wanted a break. And so, armed with a stable campaign in unstable times and a comforting message in a disquieting moment, Joe Biden completed his slow and steady march to victory exactly as he said he would. This article was written by Charlotte Alter, with additional reporting by Tessa Berenson, Washington, and Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zorthian, New York. Here's a photograph, two-page spread, huge American flag in the background, behind which a huge display of gold rocketry fireworks. Reading from left to right, the characters on the stage in front of these two phenomena, visual phenomena, Jill Biden, dressed in a lavender dress, gray shoes, wearing a black mask. She's a blonde, and she's clapping. In the center, then, next to Jill, Joe Biden in that same, I guess, dark navy or black suit. I think it's dark navy at this point. White shirt, blue tie, white handkerchief in his left jacket pocket. Black mask, gray hair, raising his hand while holding Kamala Harris, next in line, Kamala Harris's hand. Again, judging from the crinkle of her eyes, she's smiling behind that black mask. She's a brunette, wearing a black pantsuit, black shoes. Another off-white, ivory-colored, shimmery-looking blouse beneath her suit jacket. That ivory is just one tone lighter than her pale coffee-colored skin. And then on the right edge, another gentleman, I presume it is Doug Emhoff, Harris's husband. He's wearing a gray suit, a white shirt, a blue tie, a black mask. He's got short, somewhat balding, brownish-gray hair, and he's applauding. And that's the layout in that photograph. Here are a couple of shorter articles. Time Off Reviews, Television, A Working Girl for the Age of Woke Capitalism. That's W-O-K-E space capitalism by Judy Berman. The finance guy has been a stock character ever since Gordon Gekko slithered onto the screen in 1987's Wall Street, preaching the gospel of greed. We have seen nominally diversified variations on the theme, from Working Girl to Showtime's Black Monday. Yet the genre has barely evolved since the 80s, despite significant shifts in public opinion on banking, which is why it's been surprising to see HBO's industry attract so little attention. The smart, thoroughly contemporary drama follows post-collegiate recruits at fictional London firm Pierpoint and Company in an atmosphere thick with performative confidence where a tiny mistake could end a career before it's begun. New hires must prove their mettle while accounting for how their race, class, gender, and sexuality might affect their prospects in a field that is not known for its tolerance. Instead of giving us Wall Street with smartphones, the show's young cast reflects a financial services industry that is at least trying to appear inclusive. Thatcher worshiper Gus, David Johnson, attended Eton and Oxford. He's also black. Yasmin, Marisa Abella, is a rich girl who struggles to assert herself. Hari, Naban, Rizwan, is the workaholic of the bunch, while Robert, Harry Lottie, is the working-class striver who bought the wrong kind of suit. The show's most mysterious figure is its protagonist, Harper, a mixed-race American played with insight and low-key intensity by relative newcomer Mahala Harold. In a job interview montage that introduces each character, state school grad Harper proclaims, "I think mediocrity is too well hidden by parents who hire private tutors." Her bold statement pays off. Not only is she hired, but she finds a mentor in her interviewer, Eric, the always excellent Ken Lung, another outsider who's proven to be a sales superstar. A simpler drama would make Harper an easy-to-love underdog. Instead, creators Mickey Down and Conrad Kay do her justice by writing a layered character who wavers between hero and anti-hero. We are led to believe that, like Tess McGill in Working Girl and the Wolf of Wall Street author Jordan Belfort, she is a bit of an imposter. How far she will go to stay is an open question. There's a soapy element to industry, love triangles, closet cases, BDSM. The sheer number of explosive secrets among the graduates strains plausibility. Thankfully, a spare visual style cuts the silliness. Down and Kay add to the verisimilitude with dialogue that feels both cerebral and, most of the time, realistic for such an overeducated crowd. Most perceptive is how the show depicts the social dynamic within this very specific milieu. The 20-somethings of Pierpoint know how to be politically correct, yet the most privileged among them delight in offending liberal sensibilities, and others realize it behooves them to be seen as good sports. A coked-up white guy rants about woke capitalism in which I pretend to care about black people, and you pretend to hate capitalism. Harper proves she can hang by teasing him. Do you pre-rehearse those little nuggets? In fact, Harper openly reveres capitalism, and that says more about her than it might have during the Reagan years. Their many differences aside, this is what she shares with her colleagues. They're misfits, with a generation more critical of capitalism than its predecessors. In some of its best moments, the show demonstrates that they know it. Within that social context, industry is itself a risky wager. Is there even a market for characters like these? I'm feeling surprisingly bullish. Industry, the show, airs Mondays on HBO. 9 questions. Steve Kornacki, MSNBC's election guru, on polling whiffs, nonstop coverage, and becoming a heartthrob. This is written by Abby Vasoulis, and it features a photograph of a man dressed in work clothes, actually. He's wearing dark-colored slacks, a white or off-white shirt rolled up at the elbows, a striped tie with dark and light contrasting colors. The photo's in black and white. He has short, well-groomed dark hair. He's wearing glasses, and he's carrying a clipboard. And on the back of the clipboard, it says something like, Decision 2020. Question, how did you prepare to talk about the election live on air with such granularity? Answer, I likened it in the final month or so before the election to cramming for a final back in college and committing as much to muscle memory as I could. Census data, voting history, demographic trends, which counties are becoming more racially, ethnically diverse? What counties have the greater share of the sort of blue-collar, white population where Trump is expected to do well? Question. You sometimes whipped out a calculator to establish why states were too close to call. Why not have someone backstage crunch the numbers? Answer. The folks doing our system would get it at the same time, but they would have to enter it in, and it would take a minute to refresh. So, there was a bit of a lag there. I think it worked, but it was also probably for the best. Hopefully, the viewers get a sense of what this math is and how to think about the returns that they are seeing come in and why I say I'm seeing this pattern toward Biden. Question. Viewers started musing about your posterior looking good in khaki pants and calling you Map Daddy. Did you know you were becoming a heartthrob at the time? Answer. That is a very loose term, a use of the term heartthrob. It took a couple days to realize that stuff like that was happening. I did not recognize anything about it election night, or probably the day after, but I started getting family and friends sending me things. There are worse fates in life. Question, how did you survive the grueling hours? Answer, we had a little setup right behind the board. I would go back there and take a seat, and it would hit me. I would feel it, especially when we were in these 45-minute waits for new votes. I could feel dead tired, barely holding my eyes open. And then the minute the new vote came in, there was a bit of a rush in something new and in, let's see how it changes the board. Question, do you think we need to overhaul polling? That's P-O-L-L-I-N-G. Answer, yes, but I don't know how, and I don't know that anybody does know how. You could stitch together a pretty simple scenario with a swing of maybe 40,000 votes in a couple states that would get Trump in a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College. Question. Based on your knowledge of how large the margins were, do you think any instances of voter fraud would be enough to tip any states? Answer. Look, the burden's on anybody who wants to make a claim like that to present the proof. When you look at where the margins are in the key states, it's about 45,000 votes statewide in Pennsylvania, a little over 20,000 in Wisconsin, in Georgia about 12,000. No one's put forward proof of anything remotely on that scale. Were you ready for it to take this long to know who won? Did you pack extra clothes? Answer. I got a couple of ties here. I had a few pairs of clothes, but let's put it this way. I saved some money on laundry. And finally, question. Do you have advice for people who do not believe we have a victor yet? Answer. This was close. This was closer than the polls indicated. There was a moment on election night when I really was looking at it, saying, I think Trump might squeak his way through here again in the Electoral College. But there were just enough shifts in just enough states there for Biden, where he's over 270. And the question now is not if he's going to be the next president. The question is how many electoral votes exactly does he land on? We know it'll be at least 279. Will it go higher? Time off Hollywood history. David Fincher's new film, Mank, M-A-N-K, tells the origin story of Citizen Kane. Under the headings Time Off Opener and Movies, The Man Who Wrote Citizen Kane, Laid Bare, by Stephanie Zakarik. Mank will be released in select theaters November 13 before streaming on Netflix December 4. There's a photo here in the center of the double-paged article. It's a fancy open-air roadster from, I am guessing, the 1930s. With two well-dressed men in suits and ties seated in it. It looks to be stationary in front of what may be a moving backdrop, such as a projected image on a screen behind this beautiful vintage automobile with the Continental kit on the right side in front of the... the fender. Gary Oldman, Sean Purceau, and a crew member make old-school movie magic on the set of Mank. And again, that's spelled M-A-N-K. The legend of Orson Welles, O-R-S-O-N space, W-E-L-L-E-S, is a folk song with many stanzas and no end. He was a genius and a tyrant, a young rogue who either maximized or squandered his talent, depending on whom you talk to, an imperious figure who, in his last years, gained too much weight and had to peddle wine on TV commercials to make some dough. Wells and the movie that made him, 1941's Citizen Kane, are the stuff of lore. But Kane, that's K-A-N-E, would not be Kane without Herman J. Mankiewicz, the man who co-wrote, or possibly even just wrote, its script, almost without getting credit. A great wit, raconteur, heavy drinker, and gambler, Mankiewicz deserves his own wry, sardonic ballad served up with a double shot. If only more people actually remembered or cared who he was. David Fincher cares. With his new feature, Mank, he's made a movie that revels in an era when journalists, novelists, and playwrights flocked to Hollywood to make big money, sometimes screwing up their lives even in the face of their great good fortune. Mank is a clever and entertaining feat of old Hollywood hagiography. Rendered in pearlescent black and white that mimics the look of films from Mankiewicz's own lost era, it is a detail that's especially poignant since most people will end up watching Mank on comparatively small screens at home. It was produced by Netflix. But the story Fincher tells here, in a picture that revels in both beauty and ruin more than any he's made, from Seven to The Social Network, is intimate enough to resonate even on that smaller canvas. It is about carving out a grand piece of work that nearly kills you, about betraying people you care about for the sake of art, about the degree to which the people holding the purse strings also hold the power. And it is, above all, a movie made with love, and not just for the long-vanished early days of a flickering art form. The screenplay was written by Jack Fincher, a journalist and the director's father, who died in 2003. Fincher's been wanting to make this movie for years, and although it's based on real events, there's an aura of ghostly dreaminess about it, too. It is as if Fincher were trying not to recreate the past, but to communicate with it. Gary Oldman, pale, puffy, and whiskery, plays Mank, a longtime studio screenwriter and producer and former theater critic who's fallen on hard times. As the movie opens, he has suffered a car accident that puts him in a cast, rendering him nearly immobile. He can still write, though, and luckily he's been hired by Wells, played by English actor Tom Burke and seen only briefly, to come up with a screenplay. RKO Pictures has given the brash young director carte blanche to make any movie he wants with any collaborator, and Mank is his guy. Wells arranges for the sozzled genius to be wheeled off to a remote ranch in Victorville, California, not just to allow him to recover from his smash-up, but also to keep him off the sauce for a little while, at least. With the exception of booze, Mank has everything he needs to get to work. Wells has set him up with a pretty English secretary, adept at dictation. She's played by Lily Collins, who bears a shimmering resemblance to 1940s star Jennifer Jones, and has installed a persnickety babysitter in the form of John Houseman, Wells' loyal theater compatriot and a producer on the then-nascent film, played by Sam Troughton. And so Mank starts writing a dense and complex story that's something like Mank itself, an odyssey that weaves from the present to the recent and not-so-recent past in a decidedly non-linear fashion. Fincher touches on Mankiewicz's tenure as an unruly but brilliant writer at Paramount and traces his encounters with figures like bullish studio boss Louis B. Mayer and his more principled right-hand man Irving Thalberg, Arliss Howard, and Ferdinand Kingsley. Most significantly, he mines the time Mankiewicz spent earlier in the 1930s socializing with newspaper mogul William Randolph Hearst, a snootily regal Charles Dance, and his mistress, actor Marion Davies, Amanda Seyfried, at the Hearst Castle in San Simeon. Hearst would become, of course, the inspiration for Charles Foster Kane, and Mank outlines the complex and limited minuet of their friendship. Writers often mine real life for material, which means betrayal, though, as Manx suggests, it is sometimes hard to know who's betrayed whom first. But Manx is also a picture about how liberal ideals found a fertile home in early Hollywood, often in spite of the machinations of money-grubbing opportunists like Mayer. The Hollywood of the 1930s in particular had a dazzling brain trust from which to draw. In her classic essay, Raising Cain, that's K-A-N-E, Pauline Kael wrote of Mankiewicz and colleagues like Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, the writers of the play The Front Page, which became the basis for His Girl Friday. They had gone to Hollywood as a paid vacation from their playwriting or journalism, and screenwriting became their only writing. The vacation became an extended drunken party, and while they were there, in the debris of the long morning after, American letters passed them by. They were never to catch up, nor were American movies ever again to have in their midst a whole school of the richest talents of a generation. Fincher captures the aura around those words, showing us champagne-fueled parties at San Simeon, where when the conversation turns to world affairs, Manck and Davies are the only ones clear on the potential danger of the Hitler regime. Intelligence meant something in old Hollywood. It was almost as precious a resource as glamour. Fincher also captures the warm, platonic camaraderie between writer Manck and star Davies, a gifted performer whose career was more hindered than helped by her rich, famous paramour. Seyfried is marvelous here. There's always just a hint of sadness behind her resplendent smile, as if she knows exactly what Davies' life choices cost her. At one point, Manck and Davies sneak away from one of those aforementioned parties to talk in the castle garden, a rich man's zoo populated by monkeys and pachyderms. As they chat and laugh in the moonlight, and even as their talk turns to more serious things, the silhouettes of elephants loom behind them like silent chaperones, keeping an eye out for any funny business, though there isn't any. Manck is an ambitious picture constructed from multiple shifting parts. One subplot involving novelist and liberal activist Upton Sinclair's failed bid for governor of California in 1934, which may have been thwarted, at least in part, by a reel of fake news put out by Mayer, becomes a kind of sober watercolor wash over the whole movie and an echo of our own time. Manck had everything invested in being the cleverest person on the page and in the room. He was, whether credited or not, the nimble mastermind behind early Paramount delights like the Marx Brothers Duck Soup and the Gene Harlow Stunner Dinner at Eight by MGM. But he learns the hard way that words have power far beyond their entertainment value. And it is at least a minor stroke of genius that Fincher cast Bill Nye, better known as Bill Nye the Science Guy, as Sinclair. He's visible only from afar in a brief scene, but his mere presence is a nod to the supremacy of facts over dangerous fictions. For all its intelligence, Manck is not anything close to a masterpiece. It is more a pleasurable high-wire act, a movie made with care and cunning and peopled by actors who know exactly what they are doing. Oldman makes a terrific Mankiewicz, sizing up the world around him as if it were all a comic mirage and he were the only real thing in it. He was devoted, too, to his wife Sarah, played here by Tuppence Middleton, who deftly handled many thankless tasks, not least among them undressing the drunken Manck for bed. But Manck's moments of reckoning are searing, even if he's one of those truly tragic alcoholics who are more productive and sharper when inebriated. He also knows what his behavior costs him in dignity. And when he finally finishes that script, the title typed across the front is simply American, we see in his eyes what parts of his soul he had to sell for it. Mankiewicz almost did not get credit for writing Citizen Kane. In the end, he shared that credit and the Oscar with Wells. Of the two men, Wells is the one we're still talking about, and with good reason. His gifts were formidable, not just as a director, but also as an actor, a writer, and an all-around elegant rascal. But as one of Hollywood's great wags, Mankiewicz deserves an anthem of his own. And if Mank is the only one he ever gets, it is not too shabby. The history of movies, like history overall, so often works its way out from the edges. We can learn a lot from going back to read what was written in the margins and to marvel at the person who put it there. The following article will be abridged. It's under the heading Music. Ariana Grande Gets in Her Feelings on Positions by Maura Johnston. Even by the dizzying standards of the late 2010s and early 2020s, Ariana Grande has experienced a lot of low and high points over the past few years. The death of her one-time boyfriend, Mac Miller, public scrutiny of her relationships, sold-out tours and tweet storms with her legions of fans. She's also kept busy in the studio, releasing albums, as well as the occasional one-off single, that provide immediate snapshots of who she is right now. In the middle of October, Grande announced on social media she'd soon be following up 2018's Lightly Funky Sweetener and 2019's Bedheaded Thank You next with another album, her sixth overall. Positions, which Grande recorded during lockdown, came out October 30, and the album winds up being an ideal counterweight to the madness of the moment. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.